Thanks, Brother Nathan, and my dearly loved brethren and sisters in our Lord Jesus Christ. Well, I hope this is going to last. I'm sorry about last week when we had to change classes with Brother John Sevier, but I'm afraid it's actually not much better tonight. So even though I'm feeling better, it doesn't sound very well. So can you hear at the back? I presume that's the reason no one's sitting down the front here, by the way, that they don't actually want this flu or whatever it happens to be, but we'll have to try. Can you hear down the back there? Yeah, you can. They can because of the microphone. Well, on our last class, which was now 3 weeks ago, we left Joseph in the position where he'd been raised to honour and power and influence in Egypt, and so rapidly so, from being a slave in a dungeon to next moment being on the throne. It was a remarkable transformation in the twinkling of an eye almost, and it's like the resurrection is going to be. Just suddenly all the troubles of this present world will be gone, and the time of honour and influence and power that we long for so long will have come. And the days of anguish and toil and affliction that he endured in Egypt particularly, but even under the hand of his brothers back in Canaan, was put into the past, and the blessings of fruitfulness came. And we saw that at the end of chapter 41, where there's mention of his two sons that were born in Egypt, and he named them, remembering the affliction that was past and the fruitfulness of God. But through all those long years, God was at work. But who could ever have anticipated, brothers and sisters, if you were reading the earlier chapters of Genesis and you came across Genesis chapter 15, and we know these words well in one of the promises made to Abraham, and the details were revealed to Abraham that his seed would go into a strange land, and there they would serve those for a period of time and then come forward out of it. Who would ever and could ever have anticipated the outworking of God's promise there in Genesis 15, that it would actually happen the way it did? That it would begin with the hatred within the very family of promise, with one of those brethren who was the most godly of all being sold as a slave into Egypt, and him there, staying there for years, rising through the ranks, and eventually becoming effectively the prime minister of that country and bringing his brethren into Egypt to fulfill the promise that God had made. It's just amazing to see the way God's hand was working. And I don't think any of us or any of them could possibly have seen what was going on or have anticipated that. Although I do believe that that Joseph himself came at some point to see that all that was happening to him was a fulfillment of what God was doing. It's an amazing thing. He'd been given certain promises, but he also knew what had gone before. He knew all that had been given, all those promises that had been given to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob. And he exercised his minds over them quite considerably. And now what God is doing here as we begin this chapter, and we ended chapter 41, the 7 years of plenty have finished. If we like to put ourselves into perspective, this is really where we are. There's a timeline of Joseph's life, just very briefly. And from the time he was 17, he was in Potiphar's house for an indeterminate time. We don't know, because we don't know exactly how long he's in prison. But we do know that at 30, he came to the throne. Then there were 7 years of plenty and 7 years of famine. And that's where we take up the story again tonight. A couple of years into the period of famine. It's a period of approximately 22 years. It's a long time, especially in a young man's life that started at 17, that's endured all these things. But now his life has sorted itself completely, and God has placed him in a position of honour and authority. And not only has he placed him there for the next stage of his purpose, but he now starts changing world weather patterns. You know, it's recorded in Egyptian monuments and so on. There was a period around this time of 7 bumper years of the Nile. So whether that's in fact a reference to this or not, we don't know. But there were 7 absolutely amazing years, followed in quick succession by 7 miserable years of famine. And the famine, if God was going to make a famine, he wasn't interested in bringing a famine in Egypt, though Egypt was going to be the center. He's interested in getting Jacob's family into Egypt. So he sends a famine across the world. And of course, Egypt is affected by that because Egypt's dependent on the rain that happens in other parts of the world. But here God was bringing his people for further development of their character and the further ongoing development of his purpose. And so we begin right at the end of chapter 41, verse 51. And all countries came to Egypt to Joseph for to buy corn, because that the famine was so sore in all lands, everywhere this went. And the reason that the whole world suffered at that time was because there were 11 brothers, or particularly 10 of them, who God was working carefully with to bring them along the road to repentance that he'd already started bringing them along. And he was going to fulfill that purpose come what may. He'd already previously told Joseph that he would. He'd given him dreams when he was a young boy that indicated that he had work to do with these boys, and he was going to eventually bring it to fruition. And so this famine comes on, and it's sore in all those lands. And so verse 1 of chapter 42 says, "Now Jacob saw that there was corn in Egypt, and he said to his sons, 'Why do you look one upon another?'" That's a really strange thing to say. Why look ye upon another? What on earth was he talking about? You know what I think it's saying? It's saying this, brothers and sisters. None of them wanted to go to Egypt when they heard that's the only place there was food. Not one of them. Why didn't they want to go to Egypt? Because they knew. And what's beginning to happen because of God's hand in their life. And by the way, God's hand didn't just start here once they started going up into Egypt. God's been working in their lives back in Canaan for some considerable time. And they've gotten to the point where Joseph hasn't gone away from their consciences. And when here their father says, "Oh, look, I hear that the only place there's corn in Egypt is in Egypt." We're looking at one another. Who's going to go? I hope he goes. I'm not going. None of them were going to go. Till eventually he said, "Well, you'll all go." And they all went. And look who went, verse 3. "And Joseph's 10 brethren went to buy corn in Egypt." You know, when we read the Bible carefully, brethren, this is, it speaks volumes. It doesn't call them Joseph's brethren before this. Not like that. Joseph's 10 brethren went to Egypt. Why? Because that's what they're thinking. They're thinking they're Joseph's brethren. And they're going down there hoping that somehow they have nothing to do with Joseph, or that they hope that he might be dead, or that they'll never ever bump into him. Their consciences are already working from this early stage. You know, Jacob didn't trust them either, because verse 4 tells us that he didn't send Benjamin with them, because that was Joseph's brother, and Jacob sent him not with his brethren, for he said, "Lest peradventure mischief befall him." So Jacob actually still held those brothers guilty. He still thought mischief had befallen Joseph 20 years earlier at their hand, and he wasn't going to let Benjamin go. No way was he going to let Benjamin go with those men. But look at verse 5. Who comes into Egypt? It's not the sons of brethren of Joseph. It's the sons of Israel. Israel. That's the spiritual name of Jacob. The sons of Israel came to buy corn amongst those that came. And the famine was in the land of Canaan. Oh, the famine was certainly in the land of Canaan. And what's happening now, these sons, I think we're being told here by that title, that these sons are already starting to change. They are the sons of Israel. And there's no doubt, as this story unfolds, that they were already changing. And all that happened in the experiences that happened over the next couple of chapters is it was revealed to them and to the readers and to Joseph just how much change had actually been going on. And they came, we read in verse 6, says Joseph was governor over the land, and it was he that sold to all the people of the land. And Joseph's brethren came and bowed themselves down before him with their faces to the earth. That's the first time they bow of many times. It's a worthwhile exercise to colour every one of the times that they bow. There's the first. And it's not an absolute fulfilment of one of those dreams because they're not all there. There's only 10 of them there. And that's not what the dream was. What was the dream? He saw 11 sheaves bow down. But what do you think that did to Joseph as he saw them? They didn't know, he knew who they were, but he certainly knew who they were. And you think, here is the prime minister. What on earth is he at the selling desk? Where all the riffraff from the nations all come in wanting to buy a little bit of food. And Joseph's at that desk. Why isn't he in his palace? I think there's any other reason than he was waiting every day since that famine started, hoping that that famine would draw them. Because he had records, he had intelligence, and he knew how far and wide that famine had gone, and that in time they would come. And I think he'd put all that together from his dreams. He knew that God was going to work in the lives of those men. How? Because he knew that one day they were going to come and bow down. Not just, unresponsively, but that they would be changed in the process of doing that as well. Well, notice there that they're called Joseph's brethren again, and we find in verse 7 and 8 that Joseph saw his brethren and he knew them, but made himself strange unto them and spake roughly to them. In verse 8, and he knew his brethren, but they knew him not. Twice we're told he knew them. He knew them because he had a memory of them that was 20 years old, but they were grown men at the time. He was only a 17-year-old lad. He would have been difficult to have picked, but he knew their characteristics, and he'd been waiting for them to come, and now the day had come. And he made himself strange. It's a strange phrase, isn't it? He made himself strange to them. You know, brothers and sisters, there was not one ounce in anything that Joseph did through this whole story, not one ounce of revenge in any of this. Anything that happened here was for their sake and not his. And he knew at this stage there was more fruit to come. He didn't know what their hearts were revealing at this time. And I suppose in a sense, it's like us wanting the kingdom to come. Now our experience is that we are wanting Christ to come. And yet he doesn't just reveal himself now, today, just because we want him to come. He will reveal himself only after that longing and waiting and the processes have under God's hand have transpired that bring us to the time we are ready. Well, the first thing he does is falsely accuse them, as we know. He accuses them of being spies when they were absolutely innocent of that. And he challenges them about being true men. You know, notice here in verse 11, they say, in self-defense, they say, no, verse 10, nay, my Lord, but to buy food are thy servants come. We're not spies, we're just after some food. We are all one man's sons. We are all true men. Thy servants are no spies. And you can just imagine Joseph's reaction listening to those words. We are all true men. He saw them 20 years ago. That's the last time he saw them. They were all as crooked as you could possibly imagine 20 years ago. And now they're saying they're all true. You know, this issue, brethren and sisters, is the burning issue of the next three chapters. This issue of whether they are true men or not. Five times just here, three times later on in this verse 31 to 35. And it's worth getting a pencil and colouring every time it talks about them being true men. Because it really does become the turning point. Because previously they were anything else but true men. And it's the big central issue of this story. Verse 13, and they said, thy servants are 12 brethren, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. Behold, the youngest is this day with our father, and one is not. You know, they didn't actually have to say that. This man, to them, didn't know who they were. Why did they have to tell him all that detail? But they're doing it to try and impress him about their genuineness, and they're just ordinary people, and ordinary things happen in their lives, and we've just got an old father, and one's back there and one's not anymore. But it laid the very basis, verse 13, lays the basis for all that was to come after here. Because what Joseph goes on to say in verse 14, said unto them, "This is that I spake unto you, ye spies. Hereby shall ye be proved. By the life of Pharaoh ye shall not go forth hence, except your youngest brother come hither. Send one of you, and let him fetch his brother, and ye shall be kept in prison, that your words may be proved, whether there be any truth in you." So what Joseph is actually trying to do is to test how honest and truthful they were. He knew how dishonest and crooked they had been. And they had given him the opportunity. They had mentioned an old father and a brother back there and a brother that wasn't. They were the ones that had mentioned fathers and brothers. And now Joseph takes up those two things. And you're going to find in chapter 42, 43, 44, one of the driving themes is brother and father. And it's going to climax in that reading we actually had tonight that hopefully we'll get to at the end of chapter 44. This idea, because Joseph focuses their attention at their statement on their brother and indirectly at this stage on their father. And then without cause he throws them into prison. As if it was the pit. Without cause. Duration, time unknown. He didn't tell them they were going to be there for 3 days. We know that after 3 days he pulled them out. But they got clapped into irons and they had no idea how long they were going to be there. Just like Joseph, when he got thrown in that pit, had no idea how long he was going to be there. I actually think it's quite possible that Joseph was in the pit for 3 days. There's something about what happened here in this prison that connected everything back to Joseph and made their consciences work harder than they'd ever worked before. And maybe it was just some of these little details that had actually happened here that we're just told that they stayed there for 3 days. They knew what the 3 days probably meant. And in verse 18, Joseph then pulled them out after 3 days and said, "This do and live, for I fear God." And they're thinking, "Who is this man? What's he talking about? Is he talking about his own gods? Egypt had thousands. I fear God. If ye be true men, let one of your brethren be bound in the house of your prison, and go ye and carry famine for the corn for the famine of your houses," which was very severe indeed, especially the spiritual famine, "and bring your youngest brother to me, so shall your words be verified, and ye shall not die." And somehow that activated their consciences, brethren and sisters, this conscience that had troubled them for years, because they were experiencing exactly what they had done to Joseph. And they linked it. There's no question. Verse 21 tells us, "And they said one to another, verily we are guilty concerning our brother, in that we saw the anguish of his soul when he besought us, and we would not hear. Therefore has this distress come upon us." All these experiences just enlivened their conscience, and it all came back to them. And they said one to another. Did you notice? One to another. They're all in this. They're all talking about it. Their consciences are all at the same place. They're all feeling the pressure. And from this point onwards, I would like you to watch for a particular phrase. It's not always identical, but let's call it "every man," because that phrase occurs over and over again, where it includes all of these brethren together. And you're going to see it appear time and again in chapter 42, 43, and 44. Time and again it's going to come up. And what a confession that was. Here they had been verily guilty concerning the brother. You know what? They had remembered the anguish of his soul, and that he had cried out and cried out to them and they wouldn't hear. They turned a deaf ear and left him there to suffer. No doubt, actually very similar to when they got slapped in the jail by the Egyptian guard, saying, "But we're innocent. We're innocent. We're only the sons of one poor old man. We've only come to buy food." Clunk goes to jail. What did it matter if they're innocent? And what that raked up in their minds, brethren and sisters, is their own bad consciences. When someone else had cried out and they hadn't listened, and they're thinking this is all coming upon them because of what they'd done 20 years before that had never ever left them. And Reuben comes out with his response in verse 20, 22. "I told you so. I spake to you and said, don't sin against the child, but you wouldn't hear me." Imagine what Joseph's doing listening to that. That was the first Joseph knew of that. Joseph didn't know that Reuben was innocent. He didn't know who was involved in this. He would have known some of them because they were the ones that were manhandling him. And verse 24 tells us that he turned himself about from them and wept. The first of 8 times that he breaks down and turns away from them. And he pulled himself together. You know, brothers and sisters, this man was a man that was touched with the feelings of their infirmities. He bore no animosity to these 10 men that stood before him. Not one ounce of animosity. He had in his mind worked out what God was doing. He'd reconciled himself to God, and there was no personal vendetta here at all. This man was deeply wanting to reveal himself to them and to help them. But he turned away and wept privately and came back to them because he knew that there were still things that needed to be elicited from them for their own purpose, for their own good. There was still confession before them, not for him and to say that they were sorry to him, none of that. But it was to acknowledge before God where things were at, that he turned away and then came back. He was moved with emotion. You know, previously they'd never even been able to say shalom to him, and now they're confessing amongst themselves to this great sin that they'd done 20 years before. That must have been a very moving thing for him to see. And then what did he do? He grabbed hold of Simeon, or had Simeon grabbed in front of their eyes and bound right there while they're watching. He didn't cart him away and bind him in prison. He didn't ask, "Now who's going to stay?" He grabbed Simeon and bound him in front of them. It says it, in front of their eyes. Why? To evoke sympathy on their part. Identification with their brother Simeon. We don't know why Simeon was chosen. I think they did. I think they absolutely knew why Simeon was chosen. And it was just another of those myriad of things in this record that they thought, "There's something spooky about this. We just don't like it. Somehow somebody knows too much around here." Why wasn't it the eldest? Well, I think we know why it wasn't the eldest. Because Joseph had just heard Reuben's confession. Reuben wasn't involved. Simeon was next. He was the next eldest. That might have been the reason. But we know this about Simeon. He was the cruelest of them all. Even Jacob at the end of his life didn't really have anything good to say about Simeon. He was the one, along with his brother Levi, that had caused havoc and made Jacob's name to stink in the land because of his violence and vengeance on the people of the land. Can you imagine a man that's characterized like that in the rest of the scripture? What, when they're going to deal with their young brother who's being an absolute pain, not being the one to manhandle and throw him in the pit? We don't know whether he did, but I think they knew who was involved, and I think Joseph knew who was involved. And Simeon was brought out and clamped in irons in front of their eyes. But there was another test here. Verse 25. Joseph commanded to fill their sacks with corn and restore every man's money into their own sack. They generously gave all their money back. You know, brethren and sisters, every time you see the word money here in the record, it's the Hebrew word for silver. It should be translated silver. Sometimes it's translated silver, sometimes it's translated money. Cross out money, write silver. Every time. Because silver dogs their steps. And did you notice verse 25? And he restored every man, here's this word starting to appear, every man's silver into his sack. Well, this silver really got to them after a while. They hated it. Oh, at one stage they loved it because, you know, that's what they sold their brother for. They got a bit of silver. Judah said, remember, oh, what are we going to get out of it if we just kill him? If we just spill his blood, what have we got out of it? Nothing. Let's sell him and get some money and we can go and buy something. Silver, silver. They came to regret those days. They came to hate the stuff. Verse 28. And when they opened their sack's mouth and they found this in, verse 28 says, and he said unto his brethren, my money, my silver is restored, and lo, it's even in my sack. And their heart failed them, and they were afraid, saying one to another, what is this that God hath done unto us? And for the first time in 20 years, God is back in their mouths. Oh, they'd been thinking about him. And this wretched silver had gotten to them. And now they're afraid of the stuff. But God is working in their lives all through these set of circumstances. Verse 29, and they came back to Jacob, their father, in the land, and they told him, underline this word, all that befell them. You know, the last time we hear that they came back to their father and told him, you know what they told him? They told him a pack of lies. And they left him in ignorance in their self-deceit for 20 years and didn't tell him the truth. And now they're saying in Egypt, we're true men, we're true men. They come back because they've been accused of being false. They come back to their father and they tell him everything. You know what, brothers and sisters? If you read what they told him, they actually told him everything. They didn't leave anything out. And the issue was, and they told it, their father this, they accused us of not being true men, but we are true men. And you know what? I actually think that Jacob was beginning to see the signs of them being true men. He wasn't absolutely putting his trust and confidence in them, but he was beginning to see the signs. And verse 35, we come down. When they all emptied out their sacks, what did they find? Behold, every man's bundle of money was in his sack. And when they both, they and their father, saw the bundles of money, they were afraid. Oh, they were afraid, all right. Brothers and sisters, just in passing, let's not miss the lesson. Because the issue that God was really trying to sort out in their lives was, what's actually more important? Is it silver or our brother? The needs of our brother or silver, which is more important? They were faced with that challenge 20 years before and they took silver and they sold their brother. And now they're going to face that again. Because what God does in our lives, if we don't rightly discern issues, he'll bring them back and bring them back and bring them back until we rightly see the balance from his word. If we're true men, we will. And they were starting to see it. What is it, though, brethren and sisters, in our lives? Let's not just point the finger at them about their silver, because we've got plenty as well. And when there's calls for our poor brother, who's living in another place and we don't see him, how much silver do we part with? Or do we still love the silver? Well, the financial statements show us, brethren and sisters, what we value. It doesn't matter what we say, and it didn't matter what these men said either. In the end, what Joseph said as the ruler of Egypt was perfectly right. Your words will be proved by what you do. You go and show me. You go and bring your brother back here. You go and show me what that brother means to you and what your father means to you. You go back. And then I'll know whether you're true men. Well, it's a pretty big challenge, isn't it, brothers and sisters, because we're living in a terribly covetous world where our society is all caught up with silver, with buying and selling and accumulating more silver and accumulating it, though we don't even need it. We couldn't possibly think what we could have next. But of course, that's just the spiral of this age. And we forget that life doesn't consist in the abundance of things that we possess. You know, Jesus faced this in his ministry. There was a young man that came to him and said, "Oh, what shall I do to have eternal life, Lord?" And he said, "Do the commandments." Oh, he said, "I've done all those. I've been in the truth. I go to the meetings and do everything, you know." He said, go sell that thou hast and give to the poor. And he went away. That's recorded in Matthew 19, brothers and sisters. Perhaps we ought to make a note of it and go and look at it. And I'm not telling you to do something that I'm not doing myself either, because I feel that very strongly. The real issues of life are tied up with our brother and our father, not with silver. And these men came to learn that. And Jacob was distressed by all this. And he said, "All these things are against me." Wrong. All these things were not against him. All these things, verse 36, were not against him. But as we know, Romans 8 says, all things work together for good for them that love God, to them that are called according to his purpose. It appears that all things are against us sometimes, but they're actually working for us. And Jacob himself actually comes to appreciate that again. I mean, Jacob is one of those men whose emotions and ups and downs are seen right throughout the record. He's a mighty, mighty man of faith. But he falls into holes and lifts again to highs and falls down again. And here, because of the circumstances that happened in his life with Joseph, he found it very difficult to get up again. So the angels have to increase the pressure. Chapter 43, verse 1. And the famine was sore in the land. Turn up the heat. Because to perfect the saints and to bring out the final perfection of that character, we need a little heat turned up sometimes. But this provided an opportunity for these men to see themselves as they really were. And what happens now? Well, Judah emerges as a leader amongst this family. Because their father had told them to go down and buy some more corn. And Judah comes out in verse 3 and he says, "The man did solemnly protest us, saying, 'Ye shall not see my face except your brother be with us. If you will send our brother with us, we will go down. But if you won't, we will not go.'" You know, that is really showing something about Judah. It's starting to emerge about this man who comes to the fore throughout the next chapter. Because he calls him here the man. He has this awe and respect for this man. This man, whoever he was, and he didn't know who he was, he implicitly was going to obey him. He was not going to get on the wrong side. He was going to do absolutely what was right and have absolute integrity before that man. It's interesting, isn't it, that he's changing. And that pressure that God was bringing to bear here, eventually under the hand of God, brought forth fruit. Because what we find in verses 6 to 14 here, three times Jacob is not called Jacob. He's called Israel. And finally, Israel comes to the fore. In the end, as it had always been in Jacob's life, through all the struggles of life, and they're similar to ours, brothers and sisters, in the end, he prevailed through them, became a prince with God. Look at verse 8. "And Judah said unto Israel his father, 'Send the lad with me, and I will arise and go, that we may live and not die, both we and thou, and also our little ones, and I will be surety of him. Of my hand shalt thou require him. If I bring him not unto thee and set him before thee, then let me bear the blame forever.'" You know, there's a couple of things that are worth noticing in that verse, verse 8 and verse 9. The first thing is the relationship to his father. He's called there Israel, his father. And there's a growing relationship beginning between Judah and his father. That is the spiritual figure, Israel. And did you notice something that is so uncharacteristic of Judah? That he says that we live and die not, both we and thou, and also our little ones. In his earlier life, what did Judah care about little ones? Just nothing. He never took cognizance of anyone but himself. But now, the little ones are there. And not only that, verse 9 tells us, I'll be a surety. I'll take a pledge that if he doesn't come back, then I'll bear the blame forever. You know what he was saying, brothers and sisters? If he gets into trouble, I'll take his place. If he's going to die, I'll send him back and I'll die. That's a very, very different Judah than we've ever seen before. Because the previous words of Judah were these: what does it profit us if we kill him? Let's make a profit. But now he's prepared to sacrifice himself for his brother. And Jacob capitulates, gives them a present, double money, and their brother. So they go off, brothers and sisters. Isn't it interesting? They go off with some money in one hand, silver in one hand, and their brother in the other. Which did they value? What do you think they thought more of as they tromped that long road back to Egypt? Their brother Benjamin or the silver in their hand? Well, they came before Joseph, verse 16. And when Joseph saw Benjamin with them, he said unto the ruler of his house, bring them home, slay, get ready. And they sent them away. He didn't even speak to them at that stage. He just prepared. Do you think Joseph expected to see those men again? Well, he knew that they would probably have to come down for food. But do you think he was going to bring, that they would bring Benjamin? Do you think that he didn't understand how difficult it would be for Jacob to part with Benjamin? Because Benjamin was only 10 years old when Joseph was last there. And he knew that when they were sent back with the job of getting Benjamin down there to show that they are true men, it was an almost impossible task. And the only reason they managed to bring him is because they were changing men. And that even Jacob, their father, had enough confidence in the end and in the providence of God to put him in their hand. And it's now that Jacob is taking real spiritual leadership in that family. He said what might sound to be a fatalistic statement there: if I'm bereaved, I'm bereaved. But in fact, brothers and sisters, that's a mighty statement, because it tells us this. It tells us that he is prepared to accept whatever God is doing in his life. He doesn't want to be bereaved of his son, but if he is bereaved, it is clearly in God's purpose. And God takes us to that point in our lives, brothers and sisters, so that we learn to rely on him, because until we do, we are of little use. When self-will and self-interest flare up in our lives, brothers and sisters, God can use us for nothing. And it's only when we learn to trust him completely that he can use us. Well, they come back and they try to protest in the house of Joseph while they're waiting for Joseph to come. They get a hold of the steward, as we know the story goes, and they try and protest their innocence and tell him all about the silver. Look, we've brought all this silver back, and they just want to get rid of this silver. Silver, silver, all the way through here. And look what the steward of the house says in verse 23. He says, Shalom, fear not. Your God and the God of your father have given you treasure in your sacks. I had your money. This Egyptian telling him this. Your God did this. They're absolutely bewildered. But right at that very moment, and in the same breath, he says, and, verse 23, the end of verse 23, he brought Simeon out unto them. You know, the juxtaposition of those two ideas is not accidental in the divine record here. Now that they were truly no more concerned with silver, they hated the stuff, and they actually loved their brother much more than silver. When they came back and they're saying, we don't want this stuff, we want to give it to you. There must have been a mistake somehow. The steward says, your God's fixed all that, and here's your brother. Because now you obviously value your brother. And their brother's just restored to them. They didn't know whether they'd ever see Simeon again. But suddenly he's just there. And there's all manner of strange things like this that happen. We haven't got time to look at them all, but it's an interesting exercise to go right through this record and pick them out. And you might think, well, why? Why were all these funny things happening along the way? Why was Joseph sort of just giving them a bit of a hint about this and asking about their father and about their brother, their younger brother? Why did he ask about all these things? Why did he seat them in order of birth and give Benjamin, when he eventually had the feast, Benjamin 5 times? And the brothers are just in amazement. What's all this going on? Who knows something around here that we don't know? Why did he do it? I think there's one good reason. He was building a picture all through this experience with them, so that when he did finally reveal himself to them, they would have ample evidence to believe that it was in fact him. You know, when he did reveal himself to them, they were aghast and thought, no, it couldn't be. But they thought of all those other things, all the dealings they'd had with him, meant that this had to be him. You know, Jesus did exactly the same thing with his disciples. He's in the upper room and he said, I'm going to tell you that one of you is going to betray me. Now I tell you, he said, I tell you before it come to pass, that when it does come to pass, you'll believe that I'm he. And he told them that twice. So here Joseph's doing the same thing. And so verse 26 says, when Joseph came home, they brought him the little present that they'd had, and they bowed themselves to the earth. All 11 of them. Imagine the tingle that went up Joseph's spine at seeing that. These dreams that he saw fulfilled in front of his eyes right then had sustained him for 22 years. Of hardship and anguish, of disappointment. And now 11 of his brothers, just like the dream said, are bowing down. Verse 27. And he asked of their welfare and said, is your father well? The old man of whom you spake, is he yet alive? And they bowed again. And he looked upon Benjamin. He said, is this your younger brother? Can you see what Joseph is doing still, brethren and sisters? From the very first words that they said, he picked up 2 things. He picked up about his brother and about his father. They're the 2 things that Joseph was concerned about most. And it's the 2 things that they should have been concerned about most. And he kept on lifting that profile of his brother and his father. He lifted up his eyes. Now, obviously, he'd seen Benjamin before when he'd come. First of all, he'd sent them home. And even while he was there, when Joseph had first come home, he'd looked at Benjamin. But I think what it's saying is it says he lifted up his eyes and saw his brother Benjamin. He'd been deliberately not looking at him. And this was the first time that he turned his face and actually faced him and looked at him, because he knew that the moment he did that, he was going to be in trouble. And he wasn't doing that until now, but he knew he had to face this at some point, and he had to turn and he saw his mother's son. It's telling us what sort of emotion was going through him. This man, who's now 35, was about 10 or 11 when he last saw him. He's just his little kid brother. No wonder verse 30 tells us, "And Joseph made haste, for his bowels did yearn upon his brother, and he sought where to weep, and he entered into his chamber and wept there." How long for, we don't know. And his brothers have no idea why he suddenly ran out of the room and why he didn't come back in for some time, because he wasn't going to come back until he'd washed his face and he was back composed as though nothing had ever happened. And he refrained himself and he sat on bread and had the meal. Oh, what a beautiful picture of the tender feeling that was there, not only for this son, this other brother, but for all his brethren there, that he wanted just to reveal himself and be at one with them. And yet, in the purpose of God, there was more to come. And so they're sent home. The party left in verse 3 of chapter 44 in a state of elation. As soon as morning was light, the men were sent away, they and their asses all laden up and ready to go. Of course, we know what had happened, that things had been planted in their sacks again. But they didn't know that. Absolutely everything on this trip had gone unbelievably well. The ruler that they expected to be so austere was so generous, he'd even welcomed them, and had a meal at his palace. What an amazing thing. They were now in high honour. And there hadn't been any fuss about all the money that they were so worried about. And not only that, they've got all this food they're taking home. Oh, they're just the happiest men. And off they go. Not only that, they've got Benjamin with them still. And that's what Jacob was worried about. And they've got Simeon back. Everything is going right. And as one commentator wrote a beautiful sentence, and he said, "Yet within the hour, that rosy Egyptian dawn was mightily obscured by the blackest of storm clouds." Because there was one more challenge that needed to be faced. If it came down to their life or the life of their brother, which would they choose? Verse 6, chapter 44. We know the steward comes after them, and he overtook them, and he spake unto them all these words. Oh, he told them that they'd stolen his stuff. And not only that, the very cup that was so precious to this great Egyptian ruler who'd been so gracious to them to bring them into the house, and they'd stolen it. One of them had stolen it. Well, we know the story. They're just utterly perplexed. They say, "God forbid that thy servant should do such a thing. Behold, the money which we found in our sack's mouth, we brought to thee again. We hate silver. We don't like it. We wouldn't have touched it. It was made of silver. Please believe us." You know, they were absolutely straight as a die. They were so confident in their own integrity, they put their lives on the line. All of them did. And verse 11 tells us, "Then they speedily took down every man his sack to the ground and opened every man his sack." And then we know this tremendously dramatic story. The steward goes from the eldest to the youngest, one by one with great suspense, only to find, even though they were absolutely confident that they would find nothing in any of their sacks, to their shock and absolute disbelief, the cup was in Benjamin's bag. Of all of them, it was in Benjamin's. And look at the response, verse 13. "And they rent their clothes and laded every man his ass and returned to the city." You know, brothers and sisters, they didn't have to do either of those two things that are recorded there. But they rent their clothes. How significant is that? Because rending of clothes is a sign of deep grief and remorse. Remember, Jacob rent his clothes when he got the news of Joseph's death in inverted commas. And now they're rending their clothes as a sign of great grief and remorse in this whole situation, though they know they've done nothing wrong. But the last time they had to do with clothes, they're rending their brother's clothes. It was Joseph's clothes, the last set of clothes they rent. They ripped it and went to see their father, and he rent his clothes, and then they stood and watched it. Ah, these are very, very different men. There's lots of signs along the way, isn't there, that they're very different men. And they returned every man to Egypt. You know what the steward had said? I only want one man. One man. They said, no, if you find it, we'll all go. And he said, no, one. I only want one. I only want the one in whose sack that cup is. So they could all have gone free because the steward said they could have. They could have all turned on Benjamin and beaten him up and complained about why he was such a fool. They could have treated him like they treated Joseph earlier. They could have said, well, you deserve it. Get back. We're going home. Anyway, all our families are starving, so we're not going to come back to look after you. Go and take what it costs. But every one of them returned. They're changed men, brothers and sisters. And it's often only the pressure under the hand of God that changes and that reveals the true colours of our character. You know, we think, brethren and sisters, that we might even know ourselves or that we even know each other, but it's often not until the pressure really comes into our lives that we understand ourselves and we understand our brethren, because true character is revealed under pressure. I'd like you to hold your hand there. Let's go to Peter for a minute, because this is just such a far cry from where these brothers once were, but now they've reached it. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 19. He says, "For this is thankworthy, if a man for conscience toward God endure grief, suffering wrongfully. For what glory is it if when ye are buffeted for your faults ye take it patiently? But if when ye do well and suffer for it and take it patiently, this is acceptable before God." They were perfectly innocent and they joined themselves in Benjamin's plight. Just turn back a page. 1 Peter 1, verse 7. "Knowing this, that the trial of your faith," he says, "being much more precious than gold," we might add silver there as well, because silver was purified in the same way, "that perisheth, though it be tried with fire, might be found unto praise and honour and glory at the appearing of the Lord Jesus Christ." Now, that's exactly what was happening to them. Now, come to chapter 1 Peter 1 and verse 22. Because this also is very applicable to them. He says, "Seeing that ye have purified your souls in obeying the truth in the Spirit unto unfeigned love of the brethren, see that ye love one another with a pure heart fervently, being born again, not of corruptible seed, but of incorruptible by the word of God." These men, over the experiences that God was taking them through, had been transformed. So that now they didn't dispose of their brother. What was in their heart was a love for him, and they weren't going to leave him. It didn't matter whether he'd been accused of whatever. It didn't even matter whether he'd done it. They were going to go back with him. And look who goes back. Come back to chapter 44, verse 14. "And Judah and his brethren came to Joseph's house." Judah and his brethren. Judah is now the representative of all his brethren. Judah is a man of truth, brethren and sisters, because his actions have confirmed it. You remember what he said to his father? "This man won't have us, but if you put him in my hand, I'll be a surety for him. I'll take his place. I'll go into defense of him. And if it means my life, it means my life. And he'll come back to you." There he is, back in front of this great Egyptian ruler that he feared. And this time, notice what happens in verse 14. They don't do a nice bow. They fall to the ground. Oh, there's a different spirit now. God's actually bringing these men to the very point that he's going to work with them. And what did Joseph say? Verse 15. What deed is this that you've done? As they're bowing prostrated before him. It's a little parable of the judgment seat here, brethren and sisters, and we're going to pick this up in our next class. But here it is. Don't you understand that I can make judgment in all of this? And Judah steps out in verse 16. And he said, what shall we say unto my Lord? And what shall we speak, or how shall we clear ourselves? God hath found out the iniquity of thy servants. Behold, we are my Lord's servants, both we and also he with whom the cup is found. He didn't even let Benjamin speak, because Joseph had said, what's this that you've done? Obviously looking at Benjamin, because the cup was found in his. And Judah speaks. And he says, there's nothing to say. God, the first time in the divine record that the word God comes out of Judah's mouth, God has found out the iniquity of thy servants. Why did he need to tell the Egyptian ruler that? Because he's a true man. And he didn't even care whether the Egyptian ruler understood. This was the truth. And to him, it didn't even matter that he was standing in front of the ruler of the world. There was only one thing that mattered. That God had found out his iniquity. And we all deserve the punishment, he says. We all do. No excuses anymore. No pleading innocence at a time when he actually knew they were innocent. Forgets all that. Because God has brought them to face the real issue of their lives. Something that buried in their hearts, brethren and sisters, for 20 years and refused to face. Because sin blights our lives, just like it blighted theirs. Sin stunts our growth, distorts our character, makes us hideous characterizations of what God really wants in us. And yet, if only we will work under the hand of God, he can bring us to see our true position and to own it and to accept the rightful consequences of what we are and what we have done. And until, brethren and sisters, we reach the point that Judah and his brethren reached at this point, God has no work for us in the kingdom. It's a point that we all have to reach. This record is not here just so that we can read a nice story or teach it to our children, brethren and sisters. This is real. And God will take us to the same point. Well, we know what happened. Joseph came here and said, well, okay, right, you've said what you said. Should go back and say shalom to your father. All of you go back. I only need this one. How could they go back and say shalom to their father when Benjamin was in bondage? 20 years ago they had. And they still hadn't told him. Those words must have penetrated their souls like spears. It's just amazing the way God can manipulate the circumstances in our lives, brethren and sisters, to help purge our weakness and help us to stand up to face those issues that blight our lives. But then in verse 18, Judah comes near. What a risky thing that was to do to a ruler of those days. He came near unto Joseph. And he began here what I believe is the most moving and poignant declaration of faith that's ever recorded in the scriptures. Judah is a broken and a humbled man. And you know what, brethren and sisters, when we read that tonight, did you catch the power of that? I can hardly ever read that last part of Genesis 44 without having tears run down my face to listen to the earnestness and sincerity. But you know, take a bit more careful and close look at the brethren and sisters, and what do you notice? It's dominated by only three things. There are only three things in the mind of this man as he came before Joseph here, not even knowing who it was. And he didn't care whether he knew anything about God. He didn't care whether he even had any affection for his father or his brother. That didn't matter. Three things dominated his mind at this time. That was his relationship to his own father. 15 times his father is referred to in that declaration. His relationship to his brother. And there, 5 times he talks about his brother, and 8 times about the lad. The lad that's 35 years of age. And 8 times he says, "And I'm just a slave." So he's acknowledged. He's acknowledged all that Joseph was attempting to get these brothers to see. He acknowledges the special position that Benjamin has with his father. The exact counterpart of that which Joseph had with his father. Verse 21. "And thou saidest," he says, "unto thy servants, bring him down unto me, that I may set mine eyes upon him. And we said unto my lord, the lad cannot leave his father." What did they care 20 years ago about that? "For if he should leave his father would die. And thou saidest to thy servants, except your youngest brother come down with you, you shall see my face no more. And it came to pass that we came to our servant, our father, and we told him all your words. And our father said, go again. And we said, we can't go, because the man said, you've got to bring your brother down. Verse 27, "And thy servant, my father, said unto us, you know that my wife bare me 2 sons. Where's Judah? He wasn't one of those 2. He doesn't even count. And for envy, he and his brothers had taken Joseph earlier, and not now. They accept that they're not even worthy to be called his sons. One went out from him, and I said, surely he's torn in pieces, and I saw him not. And if you take this also from me, if mischief befall me, you shall bring down my grey hairs with sorrow to the grave. Now therefore, when I come to thy servant my father, and the lad be not with us, seeing that his life is bound up with the lad's life, it shall come to pass, when he seeth the lad is not with us, that he will die. And thy servant shall bring down the grey hairs of thy servant our father with sorrow to the grave. For thy servant became surety for the lad unto thy father, saying, if I bring him not to thee, then I shall bear the blame to my father forever. Now therefore, I pray thee, let thy servant abide instead of the lad a bondman to my lord, and let the lad go up to with his brethren. For how shall I go to my father, and the lad be not with me, lest peradventure I see the evil that shall come on my father?" And he bowed himself in wretchedness and humility at the feet of that man. He's now prepared to sacrifice his own life for his brother. Because he is, he proves that he was a man of truth. But did you notice the ultimate reason for the transformation of this man? It was the father. In the end, he couldn't bear to see the grief that would come upon his father. You know, brethren and sisters, how often in our lives does grief come to our father? By our deceit and our evil works. And Judah had learnt by experience the depth of that grief. He'd watched his father for 20 years. Never get over that. And that's a powerful image that ought to burn into our brains. The most powerful reason that we should never, ever go in the way of sin and walk in the way of unrighteousness is because it hurts our Father. It ought to be the greatest constraining influence in our lives. And for Judah it was now. But it just wasn't that. And it wasn't just his brother, Benjamin. It was all his brethren. Because at one stage, they were all in this together. But now he said, I'm not important. I'll stay. Please let Benjamin go home. And all his brothers too. And at that point, brothers and sisters, when we reach that point in our life, God can work with us. You know, this is the man, brothers and sisters, of Genesis 37 and 38. He's a man who's characterized in the past by violence, being unfeeling. He wouldn't hear the cries of his brother, as being mercenary, as being deceitful, dishonest, heartless. He hated his brothers. He envied them. He was murderous. He mocked. And he was a leader amongst all of that. He had friends in the world and he married outside. He had wicked children. He was dishonest even within his own family. He was an immoral man. He had no recognition of God in all his ways and no conscience before God. And look at him! Not one of us would have given this man another chance. Not one of us would have. And yet God did. And God, working through the tribulations and circumstances of his life and through the sufferings of Joseph, had brought him to this point. It is amazing what God is able to do with any of us, brethren and sisters. And none of us should ever, ever give up. Because if only we can turn again, as Judah did and his brothers, if only we can turn again, God's arms will be there to welcome. And he will guide through the circumstances and difficulties of life to the perfecting of our characters and the changing of those things. But you know, the overriding real challenge, I think, of this part of the story of Joseph is, are we really true men? That was the challenge that Joseph put to them. And they proved that they were. And they proved that they were because of their love of their brother. And their love of their father. And it just brings together so beautifully what Jesus himself said. When asked what the very first commandment was, he said, it is to love Yahweh your God with all your heart, soul and strength, and your neighbor or your brother as yourself.